It's my utmost pleasure to welcome you to our yet next lecture in our machine learning for Greenhorse course. This time it's in these different settings. Thank you very much for accommodating. I unfortunately was kind of sick, so I had to stay at home. So thanks, whether you are here online or whether you are watching it from the recordings. Before I will start talking myself, are there any questions or comments or anything on your side? You would like to know something about some assignment, about some theory, about anything? Nope. Okay, then let's get to it. Now, this lecture has been prepared newly or differently for this year. So it will be more experimental because most of the materials which I have are completely new. So we will see how it goes. If at some point I am too fast or too slow, then please don't hesitate to tell me. Also, know that I have a chat open, so if you'd like to say something without actually speaking, then feel free to really write in the chat, and I should be able to react whenever you write a question. So we ended up with SVMs on the last lecture. And they are now closed, right? So what we have seen is we have seen like a family of models which start with linear regression and then ends with an MLP, right? Which tends to work very well, especially if we have a lot of data, then it's really like a good thing. Then we discussed the SVM, specifically the dual formulation with the kernels, which was also useful, specifically in the this SVM has this dual formulation, which is useful, especially when we have like a moderate amount of training data, so something like tens or hundreds k's of training data, and they are like feature rich. Maybe they have a lot of features, maybe we want to create a lot of combinations of the features, or maybe we think the RBF kernel would be useful, and so on. So in these settings, the SVMs might help as well. Now we will discuss a quite different approach, well, yet another different approach, how to construct some kind of a classifier, which will be the naive Bayes. And whenever we'll get there, we'll see what are the trade-offs and when are the situations where using it instead of some MLP or SVM might be a good idea. So that's the idea for today's lecture. And we will start by something specific. We will start by considering document representation. Like, we know what to do with images, we know what to do with the categorical variables, well, use one-hot encoding. We can even represent letters and words, but imagine that we have a document, right? Not just a word, but a sequence of words, or maybe just a sentence, but maybe several sentences. So in order to do that, we usually turn to something which is called a bag of words. So we represent the document using just the words which appear in the document without actually caring about their order. Right, so it's like really, that's why it's called a bag of words. You can imagine that you will just take all the words and then just put them into one bag and lose the information about the positions. So technically what it means is that we create a feature space where each feature will correspond to a unique word, right? And then the document can be, I don't know, a lot of zeros and maybe some ones under, right? Like a generalization of this one of the encoding, for example. Now, in this context, these words or character sequences or anything, they are usually called terms, right? So we can have such a feature space. But the question is, what are the values of the individual features going to be? Like I have used zeros and ones in the image, but maybe there are some other ways how it can be done, right? So apart from this binary indicators, which just tells you whether a term is present or is not present in a given document, we might consider, for example, term frequency. This is like a natural idea that we will give like a probability to every term, right? Such that the sum of all these probabilities is really one, right? So for each term, we take the number of its occurrence divided by the number of terms in the document and get here like a distribution, like it's like a distribution of terms in the document. So that sounds reasonable because compared to the binary indicators, it give us additional information of how frequent the individual terms were. So that's one way through which we can improve our representation. The other way which we can take is to say, okay, in the term frequency, we kind of thought that the words which are more frequent are like more important, right? Or maybe stronger, or maybe we should care more about them, that they are more interesting. There is also another measure which could be understood as like an interest of a term or of a value of a term. And that's something called inverse document frequency. And inverse document frequency, that's generally, so let's start maybe with the example. So consider, for example, the word V. Now, if you have a collection of a lot of documents, then this word is going to be in many of them, right? Probably in most of them if it's an English collection. And its frequency will be quite high. So it seems it might be like an important word. But the thing is, it's actually not very important because like it's just a word which is like everywhere, right? It's present really whenever you will just look into the document, it will be there, but it has no specific role. It's just like a syntactic word which you need to use, but it doesn't tell you anything important about the document. And the inverse document frequency is trying to explicitly describe this notion by looking at the number of documents which contains the given term. And the idea is that if this number is large, if a word is present in many documents, then it's probably not very useful, right? Because, well, we can predict beforehand it will be present in the document, right? If we have a word like the, then well, it's present everywhere. So if we see it in the document, we will actually not learn much, right? On the other hand, terms which appear only in very small number of documents, maybe let's say just two documents, then they will probably be quite relevant to the content, or they might be relevant to the content of these documents. So to quantify this, we use the inverse document frequency. So inverse document frequency is like the number of documents which contain the term T divided by the number of documents. So it's like a frequency again, but this time it's a frequency of documents where a given term is. And out of this quantity, we take the minus logarithm. So why minus logarithm? That's not very obvious right now. But We can draw the effect of that. So imagine that the document frequency is very close to one. It's something like this. Then the minus logarithm of that, say like a small weight. And then the less frequent a term is across the corpus, the larger value, this like negative log of this document frequency actually is. So the less frequent, the much more weight we are actually getting, right? So the idea is probably that the difference between one and two documents is quite large. So that's why we are computing the logarithm, because the logarithm at that point behaves more like an exponentiation. So we are fixed, or we are focused more on this area where the document frequency is quite low. Now that we can understand this actually as a self-information of the probability that some document contains a given term, right? So this gives us a surprise, like the amount of information which we get if we see a document containing this term, right? This kind of makes sense. If we see document containing the, then, well, we haven't learned much, because most documents do. But if we find a document which contains the word, I don't know, I have no good word. So, I don't know, variational autoencoder, then we have a better idea of what the document is going to talk about. And now these two dimensions, like the frequency of terms and the specificity of the term in the corpora, gives rise to something which is called TF-IDF, which is the product of the term frequency and the inverse document frequency. And this is a feature which has been used in various both text recommender systems or previous versions of like information retrieval and Google like searches and so on. So this combination seems to really be like a good one. And for example, in 2015, a large portion of existing recommender system actually use this feature. Now, with the BERT-like model and extremely deep neural networks, people have arrived at slightly better features. So nowadays, the number wouldn't be that high, but still, if you want to process text in this like old school way, then using TF-IDF as a feature for your document is definitely a good idea. By the way, because we are computing the logarithm here, then usually we add here plus one, really just from the technical reason, because otherwise, if we have a term which is not present in the corpora at all, then we would be computing the logarithm of zero, and or that would really be complicated. So I'm starting with this because we'll be using TF-IDFs, right? So you can imagine through the whole sort of today's lecture that we have a document and we want, I don't know, to classify it. Maybe we get a document my children are playing football, and you would like to say, okay, that's sports and family, or something like this. So first we need the features, and for the features, what I propose is to take the terms and use the TF-IDF. And we'll then see some algorithms which will be able to work with these representations. But now I've kind of started with some ad hoc thing, right? It's like, until now I was like, I don't like when things just fall out of the sky, and now there are two full slides falling out of the sky. So before we will get further, we will first think or discuss why using TF-IDF might be a good idea. So in order to see where the TF-IDF comes from, we will need to define something called mutual information. So let's have two random variables, x and y, which have distribution x and y. Now we can definitely talk about conditional entropy. Right, we have actually seen it already, but formally we have defined usual entropy. And now if we would be interested in the conditional entropy, with the entropy of this conditional distribution, what we could do is we could compute the self-information of this conditional distribution, right? And then compute the expectation of that, because that's what the entropy was, an expectation of the self-information. So here it could be an expectation of the conditional self-information, and then here there will be x and y. Now, this might seem slight weird, because in the entropy originally we had px log px. So now when we are interested in conditional distribution, one would may think that these things should be the same, and they are not. And this is actually correct, right? So this is just a fluke that they were the same in this setting. But if you look at it as the expectation of the self-information, then the expectation cannot really run over this conditional y or x. It really needs to consider all possible combinations of x and y, and for each combination, we consider the conditional probability. So that's just conditional entropy. And now, because we started with two distributions, what we are interested in is the relation of two of these two random variables. Specifically, we'll be interested in the amount of information shared between these two random variables. And now consider the difference between entropy of y and the conditional entropy of y given x. So what does this mean, right? This entropy of y tells us what is the average amount of information which we get when we observe y, right? And this part that tells us what is the average amount of information which we get when we observe y and already know the value of x. So we can interpret this value as how much do we learn about y when we see a value of x, right? Why it is? So let's say that the y and x are completely independent, right? If they are independent, then this is not really here, and we get zero, right? And then the entropy of y is the same independently on whether we are seeing x, if they are independent. So by seeing x, we have not learned anything about y. On the other hand, if y is can be computed from x, like if it's really like a specific quality, if it's really dependent on x, then observing x means we are seeing we know what the y is. So in this case, this entropy would be zero, right? Once we have seen x, there is no surprise, no information in y anymore. So if we subtract these two qualities, like what is the amount of information in y and what is the amount of information in y if we know x, then we can understand this as we can understand the difference as what amount of information will we learn about y if we found out x, right? So we know nothing, then we learn x and we learn some amount of information, like that's this quantity, it will have a name later. And then there is still some information left right? And the missing information, that's the entropy of the conditional distribution. So technically, when we look at this difference, from the definition, we can see that this is the expectation of negative log py minus the expectation of negative log of the conditional probability. So we can merge those expectations together. And then we can also say or rewrite this conditional probability into Pxy divided by Px, so that this difference can actually be computed as the expectation of this quantity of the joint probability divided by the probability of X and probability of Y. So given that it has this nice interpretation, like what is the amount of information shared between X and Y, it has a name, it's called mutual information, so it's denoted as Y, X and Y, I, X and Y. You have seen the definition. So what can we see from this formula? First, it's symmetrical, right? There is, if you swap X and Y's here, nothing actually changes, it's still the same. So the mutual information between two variables is the same. So these two differences actually have the same value. I'm definitely not saying that the entropy of X needs to be the entropy of Y. That's not true. But the amount of information shared between them, that's still the same. Mm-hmm. Now, it's easy to actually verify, even if not come up with it on your own, that the mutual information is just the KL divergence between the joint distribution and the factorized distribution Px and Py, right? The KL divergence I am actually missing a logarithm here, right? Because the logarithms were here, but they cannot just disappear. So the log should be here, and the log should be here there. I'm sorry, I said I was preparing the things anew, and unfortunately, there is an error here. So now, at this point, we know that the KL divergence, like a difference between two distributions, right? Can be computed as an expectation over P of the logarithm P minus logarithm Q. So once that's recalled, it's easy to see that this KL divergence is actually this quantity. And from that, we immediately see that this neutral information is a non-negative and that it's zero if and only if the joint distribution and the factorized distribution are the same, which is equal to the situation where the random variables are independent. That kind of makes sense, right? The two variables have no shared mutual information if they are independent of each other. So that's one interesting quantity, which we can consider like a generalization of entropy to two different random variables. So now let's see how this TF-IDF can actually be considered or derived or why it's connected to a mutual information. So let's say that we have a collection of N documents and these documents contains some number of terms and that we have got T and T is like a collection of unique terms present in the documents. So our assumption will be that whenever we are choosing or drawing a document, we do it uniformly randomly. And the same if we are choosing a term, that we are choosing it uniformly randomly. That's the assumption which we will use. And from this, from which the TF-IDF will be based on. So in this setting, the probability of a single document is really just 1/1 the size of the collection of the documents. This also means that the self-information of the document and also the entropy of the collection of the documents is just the logarithm of the amount of documents in it, right? This comes directly from the uniformity of how we consider the documents. Now consider probability of a document given some term, right? So we have a term and we would like to consider what the probability of a document is, if it should contain the term. Well, again, we are choosing uniformly, so it's 1 over the number of documents which actually contain this term. And again, the self-information and also entropy is just the logarithm of the number of the documents containing P. And so now let's look at the difference between D, like the self-information of a document, and the document if we have a given term. Well, it's really just the difference between these two quantities. So it's just the logarithm of the inverse document frequency. So this is really IDF. So this IDF is like a part of mutual information if some term is given. Like if we have a term, this term gives us some amount of information about a document. Right, and this amount of information which we learn is actually the IDF. But this works for a given term, right? So if we consider the whole collection of the documents with all terms, then the self-information of that, the mutual information of that is, well, the difference between this information in the document and the document given term. So you can understand this as like the amount of info between the document and the term. And this is weighted by the probability of that document term pair, right? So we consider all documents on terms. The probability of a document, well, just the uniform one. And then if you have a document, then the probability of term in a document, well, that's just the term frequency, right? So the mutual information is actually a sum over all document and term pairs of the TF-IDF and then divided by some constant. So from this, we see that these TF-IDF terms really recover the mutual information between D and T, between the documents and the terms. So if the mutual information gives us like the amount of information between the document and the term, then the TF-IDF carries like small, like bits of information, which are attached to the individual document term pairs, right? So the TF-IDF is the larger, the more information flows or is between a given document and term. So from this point of view, it makes sense to use this as a feature because it somehow quantifies the shared information between these two objects. So that's the TF-IDF. Like generally, unless we are using really very deep neural networks, then this is how we represent some larger texts. It's of course bad or sad to give up the positions of the words, but it's generally just too difficult to also include this information somehow. So if we care about the position, we can consider various windows as we have done it in the diacritization assignments, right? But once you want to process a document of a variable length, then saying, okay, we just really consider some dictionary, and for each word, we somehow compute like the amount of information shared between this word and the document, then that definitely makes sense. So that's one topic of the today's lecture. We will use it then on the practicals in the two assignments to get an idea of how to actually use such features for some kind of non-trivial text processing. And now we will start going the Bayesian way to end up with a naive Bayes classifier. So until now, we have used the standard, classical, sometimes also called frequentist probability. And until now, the probability of an event was really like a limit of its frequency. When we wanted to know the probability that the coin would fall down on heads, what we could do is we could simulate the flips a lot of times and then really consider the more and more attempts or trials, and then the limit, the ratio of when it went heads or tails, would be the probability. Right, so that's one way how you can look at the probability. It's like really we can repeat experiments; they will always end up either this or that, and we count, and from that we compute frequencies, and from that we get probabilities. Now, in Bayesian probability, it works slightly differently. So instead of being like a frequency of some outcome, the probability is really like a quantification of uncertainty. Like it seems like a trivial thing to say. So it seems, why am I saying this? Like this is like a normal thing. Like, but it is actually different. For example, when you consider logic, then even with the frequentist probability, things are either true or false. So if you have a hypothesis, it's still true or false, and then you need to do experiment and see whether it's true or false. But with Bayesian probability, we will be really able to assign probabilities to hypotheses. So one way how we can look at the Bayesian probability is that like an extension of logic, which really allows you to give non-trivial probabilities to hypotheses. All right. So, for example, in the frequentist probability, it would be difficult to estimate the the number of floods, number of extra large floods. So these things happen very rarely. So being able to measure some non-trivial amount of them is quite difficult. Instead, we need to really consider in this uncertainty framework, what is the chance that it will actually happen or not. But not that we would see it many times and then estimate the chance from it, but instead arriving at the probability in a different way. So this Bayesian probability is the so-called evidential probability. So it works by our hypothesis, having some initial probability. This initial probability is usually called a prior probability, what is there at the beginning. And then in the light of new data, of new evidence, we update this initial probability into a new and updated one, which is called a posterior probability. So this prior getting updated with evidence data into posterior, it's like a basic setting or the basic signature of the Bayesian probability. Now this happens using the Bayes theorem, right? The Bayes theorem says that the probability of A given B can be rewritten as the probability of B given A times probability of A divided by probability of B. Like I assume we have already seen this. And this is something what lies at the center really of the Bayesian probability. So to get an idea of how does this work in practice, consider the following problem, and this is from a book called Thinking Fast and Slow. So let's assume that Steve was selected at random from a representative sample, right, from the population of a suitable state or something. Now he has been described by a neighbor as follows. Steve is very shy and withdrawn, invariably helpful, but with little interest in people or in world of reality. Like a meek and tidy soul, he has a need for order and structure and a passion for detail. Now, after this description, is Steve more likely to be a librarian or a farmer? Now, when you hear such a description, then you'd probably say that he is a farmer, sorry, he's a librarian, because like the whole description like points to someone we kind of expect to be happy around books. And that's not really a bad idea. Really, the description seems to be matching more a librarian than a farmer. That's fine. However, if we are talking about whether Steve is more likely to be a librarian or farmer, we also need to include the base rates, right? The fact is that there are many more farmers than librarians. So I did some research, and for example, in Czech in 2016, there were 4,330 librarians, while there were quite a lot of agricultural workers. So I only included the regular ones, the ones who did it just for a smaller amount of time, I didn't include. But even with these counts, there is a 30-to-1 ratio. So yes, this description definitely fits more librarian. But the question is whether it fits a librarian 30 times more than it fits farmer, right? Because there are so many more farmers than librarians. So I'm not saying that it's obvious what the answer to this is. I'm just saying that we need also to include the fact that we are not interested in just the fact that the probability of this description given a librarian is high. Like, that's true. If somebody is librarian, then this description is probably has a large probability. But if you are interested in the other order, if we are interested in knowing whether somebody is a librarian, if we have this description, we need to include the base rate, the probability that somebody is actually a librarian, which will then diminish this this quantity. And now this is really just another interpretation or formulation of the Bayes theorem, right? And we had our prior, and that's being a librarian or a farmer without any description, right? Then we have likelihood. That's the chance or the value or the weight, how much this description actually fits a librarian. And combining them, we get a posterior. Now, I'm calling this middle thing likelihood. And that's because it is actually a likelihood. If you remember, likelihood is like a conditional distribution where we don't change this outcome. Instead, we think about the parameters. Like, that's what we did in the maximum likelihood estimation. We have got the probability of X given the weights, and now the data are fixed, right? The description here is fixed as well. What we think about is whether Steve is farmer or a librarian. So that's why I'm calling this a likelihood. While this is a distribution, and this is again a distribution. So let's now use or demonstrate this Bayesian approach on model fitting. We have already, or we have been using the maximum likelihood estimation in most of our lectures until now. And there, what we did, we said, okay, we want to maximize the probability of the gate data given some weights, right? And we iterated over all possible weights whatever gave us the largest probability we have used. Now, in Bayesian interpretation, we also need to capture our initial assumptions about these weights using some prior probability. That's what the Bayesian approach does. It has some initial probability, the prior probability, which is then modified by the likelihood, like updated with new evidence to generate the posterior. So we need some prior. Now, if we had some prior, then we can say that the probability of the weights, if we have some data set, is using the Bayes theorem, the prior times likelihood divided by the probability of the data. So this quantity, that's the same as which we used in the maximum likelihood estimation, right? So that's just the likelihood, which tells us how well do the weights describe the current data. And again, the data is fixed by, and we are changing the weight. So it's really, again, a likelihood similarly to why it was a likelihood in the previous case. So what we get is that the posterior, like the new information about the weights, is proportional to the likelihood times the prior. And by this proportional to, by this weird symbol, what I mean up to a multiplicative factor, right? So F is proportional to G if there exists some constant such that F is C times G. And now, if our goal is to find, for example, the weights with the largest posterior, then we don't really care about this Px, right? If X is given, if we have got some fixed data, then this constant is still the same. So that's why we don't include it here. We hide it in this proportional to, because when we consider the best possible set of weights, this Px is not really important there. So using this formula, we can define an alternative to maximum likelihood, and that's a maximum a posteriori estimate, MAP estimate. And in MAP estimate, what we do is we maximize the probability of weights given the data, which amounts to the prior probability times the likelihood, right? So the only new thing with respect to the maximum likelihood estimation is the inclusion of the prior. And we can understand this prior as some kind of a preference among the models, right? That's something which tells us which models do we like if we don't consider the data. For example, we tried to say that we want simple models from the Occam razor, right? Or maybe we want some unbiased, fair models or something. And all this information could be built up somehow, maybe, into the prior, which we also use when we consider the weight or the model during training. Some go that far as saying that the overfitting problem is just a problem of not using prior, of concentrating only on the data and nothing more, instead of building some additional initial expectation to the model, and that suitable priors would be actually enough to avoid overfitting altogether. So I wouldn't go to such an extreme formulation, but it's definitely one way how you can look at it, that the problem of overfitting is that you concentrate on the data and nothing more, right? But there are some additional assumptions or expectations which probably your model might fulfill. So let's see how we can actually derive the L2-regularization in these settings. So if we are training a model, what our prior about the weights would be? Well, we can say that the mean could be zero. Like, it's difficult to say what the mean should be. So zero is a nice symmetrical quantity, so why not? And what about the variance? So let's say that the variance is assumed to be some constant, right? That seems reasonable, like that we probably prefer models with weights around zero, and the larger the weights are, the less we prefer them. Now, if we have a mean and variance and nothing more, we can again employ the maximum entropy principle and tell us, okay, so let's assume that our prior on the weights is just a normal distribution with zero mean and some fixed variance. And now, let's consider this maximum a posteriori estimate. Now, what do we have there? We have there the likelihood. Now we swap minimum and maximum and the product to sum. So this is something which we have seen for this first half, right? We also have here this prior. Now, once the logarithms are there, we will just get the negative log probability of the prior. And now, if this prior is just a normal distribution, then the logarithm of that is some constant which contains no w's. And then we have the exponent, right? The exponent in the normal distribution is e to minus x minus mean squared divided by 2 sigma squared. So our mean is 0, so this really goes away, and we get this. Well, and when you look at it, then this is, in fact, L2 regularization, right? This is the L2 norm of the weights, and then here is some constant, which depends on the variance, right? So another way how we can look at L2 regularization is that if we have an initial prior, which tells us where we kind of expect the weights to be small, then we don't need to edit in some ad hoc weight loss. Instead, we can express it as a prior, right? And then we will get the L2 regularization automatically. Right? This also shows you like why two, right? Because it depends on the distribution. If you decide, okay, my prior is that the weights are normally distributed, and then gets you L2 regularization. If instead you have chosen a different distribution, you could maybe get L1 regularization or L3 or anything else. Yep. So that's some very quick intro to Bayesian probability. And now we will expand our toolbox of probability distributions. These two parts, the beta distribution and the Dirichlet distribution, there will be some danger sum appearing soon. So they are mostly meant to give you an idea of what kind of tools are required to actually like use this Bayesian approach to probability. Anyway, we've already discussed the Bernoulli distribution, right? Now, what we could do is we could expand it into the so-called binomial distribution. In the binomial distribution, we repeat the Bernoulli trial, like the experiment in the Bernoulli distribution, multiple times. So let's say n number of times. So we have a coin, right? Single flip is Bernoulli distributed. If we then flip the coin n times, then what are the outcomes? Well, the outcomes are either zero heads, one head, two heads, until n heads, right? And these outcomes from zero to n, they have a so-called binomial distribution. So the binomial distribution is parameterized by the number of trials and then the probability of success of a single trial. So this is really just like a sequential application of a Bernoulli distribution. So if we have a random variable which is distributed according to this distribution, then the probability of observing k successes is, well, k times, so we need to succeed with probability phi, then n minus times, we need to fail with probability 1 minus phi, and then out of these and possibilities, right? There are several ways, like which k times we could succeed, right? If we want to succeed three times, then we could consider various time slots in which the successes would happen. And this is captured by the binomial coefficient, n over k, right? And that tells you how many ways you can draw a k-tuple out of an element, and it can be computed using the factorials. So this is something which you have probably seen, and if not, this deriving this binomial distribution from binomial theorem would be probably simple. So now, assume that we have done perform this Bernoulli trial for n times. That's actually the same thing as seeing a single outcome of this binomial distributed random variable, right? The binomial distribution is relay like a sequential application of the previous one. In any case, after n outcomes, what we could do is we could come up with some estimate of this parameter phi. Right. So what's happening now? Somebody is throwing a coin. They threw it 10 times. Right. Then tosses. And in 4, we have seen heads. So now, what we might want to do is we might want to say, okay, what is the parameter of the Bernoulli distribution? What is the original phi? And for that, we could use maximum likelihood. Right, and what we would expect is to obtain something like 4/10, because that seems like a reasonable probability of actually getting heads. So, in the context of the Bayesian inference, we wouldn't just use the likelihood to come up with this parameter. We would start with some prior. Right, some initial idea of what the value of this phi might be, and then compute the posterior after any amount of observed data. We don't need to compute the posterior only after all the n outcomes. We can actually compute it like after any amount of trials, even after every single trial. So we could actually compute the posterior after every single observed data. So it's like really like a sequential inference process. Now, what does this mean? Is that we have some prior, which through the likelihood gets transformed into the posterior, right? But then once we have new data, then this posterior will play a role of a prior, again, it will be modified by the evidence and we will get the new posterior. And then if we get new data, this posterior will again play a role of a prior, and then it will be updated by the observations, and so on and so on. And so for that, it would be extremely useful if the form of the prior and the posterior would be the same, right? If technically it was, for example, the same family distribution or something, then we could repeat this process as many times as required. And that's exactly what we need to do. So if we have some likelihood, then we are quite often interested in a distribution for if we take a prior in this distribution and apply the likelihood function, we get a posterior in the same distribution. And such a distribution is called a conjugate prior. So let's now think about what the conjugate prior for Bernoulli distribution is. So the probability of the Bernoulli distribution, well, it contains phi to x and 1 minus phi to 1 minus x. So either we add phi or we add 1 minus phi, depending on the outcome. So if we want a prior which will keep the same form after being applied by this quantity, then ideally what it would do is it would be a product of some phi's and 1 minus phi factors. So what we will do is we will seek for a prior which will be in the form of x to something and 1 minus x to something else. So for technical reasons, because we already know how it will turn up, we will say that x is to alpha minus 1 and 1 minus x is to beta minus 1. And we will call this distribution a beta distribution, right? Is two parameters, alpha and beta. Now, right now, I'm just saying that it's proportional to, right? Because this doesn't necessarily need to sum or integrate to 1. So we need to do that and to this quantity, this normalization factor, this integral of this quantity from 0 to 1, it's called a beta function. It's denoted as b alpha beta. And it actually can be explicitly computed using the gamma function. So this is not really that important. But what we get out of that is that the conjugate prior of a Bernoulli distribution, and also of the binomial distribution, of course, is the beta distribution And we have there these x to something and 1 minus x to something. And that was the result of the form of the likelihood, right? So the form of the likelihood is actually what prescribes the conjugate prime. And there is some normalization constant making sure that this is actually a distribution. So I'm saying that this is some weird gamma. So this is just for fun, this gamma function, which you might see meet somewhere, that's like extension of a factorial to complex numbers. This can be useful in many cases. So gamma of n for natural numbers is just n minus 1 factorial, but it can be computed for any complex number apart from the negative natural numbers. It's defined by some integral and by some basic algebra like calculus stuff. You can actually verify that for 1 it returns 1, and gamma for z plus 1 returns z times gamma z. And now these are enough to actually see that this is actually a factorial, right? Because if we start at some value, I don't know, 4, then according to this, it's 3 times gamma 3, and that's 3 times 2 times gamma 2, and that's 3 times 2 times 1, gamma times is 1, and we are done, right? But the good thing is this actually work for numbers like 4.5, for which computing the factorial is probably more tricky. In any case, we have the beta distribution, right? So it is two hyperparameters. Let's say that we have the prior beta, which contains the alpha and beta parameters. And let's consider that we observe k successes and l failures. So what will happen? Well, the k successes will add this phi to k to the posterior, and the l failures will contribute this 1 minus phi. So when we consider the prior, then what happens is that k is being added to this exponent and l is being added to this exponent. So the posterior will actually have parameters alpha plus k and beta plus l. So these alphas and betas, they can actually be considered counts of successes and failures, right? Because whenever we observe success or failure, plus one gets to be added either to the success or to the failure. So if it is like that, then having some non-trivial prior actually corresponds to something which is called a pseudo observation. Like we might say that even if we haven't seen anything, we might say our prior information is that we consider that, for example, the coin was heads once and tails for the second point. By the way, if you consider beta for beta 1-1, the beta 1-1 is still a uniform distribution, right? That's this one. That's kind of obvious because if alpha is 1, then this is 0. If beta is 1, this is 0. And so this is just proportional to 1, and it's really like a uniform distribution. So that's the most natural prior is to start with beta 1-1, because that means we don't know anything. Like we consider all the values of the probability of success to be uniform. And because it's like this, 1-1 means no information, then we see that this beta with these A and B parameters corresponds to alpha minus 1 successes and beta minus 1 failures. Right, and it can be shown that the mode, that the point of largest probability of the beta distribution, which observed k successes and l failures, is what you would expect, k over k plus l. So if you consider, for example, this version, then here we have one success and four failures. So we can see that the mode is really 1/5, so the probability of 20%. So this beta distribution seems weird, but in the end, at least if the parameters are integral, then they behave in the way how you would expect. But the good thing about them is that they can be used also in the situations where, for example, these counts are not just integral numbers, but some non-trivial numbers. And that we can explicitly think about various kind of prior information which we might have. Note that the priors, they are mostly important at the beginning, like when we have little observations. Generally, the more and more observation we see, the closer the posteriors are going to be. Like the priors are there, and they are important at the beginning if we don't have enough evidence. If we have a lot of evidence, then probably any our prior information should be like lost and ignored if we have like a real data, which says something different. So this was all to show you the conjugate prior for the Bernoulli distribution, the beta distribution, and that we can actually interpret it as counts of successes and failures. Yep. And that the priors then can correspond to some artificial observations of successes and failures. Now, similarly, as we have extended the Bernoulli trials into the binomial distribution, we can extend the categorical distribution into the so-called multinomial distributions by considering n repeats, right? In categorical distribution, we have chosen one out of k classes. So in multinomial distribution, we will choose one out of k classes n times, right? So the outcome will not be just one class is selected, but actually k results. Now, this is really just an extension of the binomial, right? In the binomial, we just consider two classes, success or failure. Now we have multiple classes. So the multinomial distribution is parameterized with the probability, right? Probability of observing a single outcome. And then the number of trials, and then the chance of observing some number of outcomes for a category K is, well, there had to be X1 outcomes for the category 1, X2 outcomes for the category 2, until XK outcomes of the category K. And we need to consider how many ways we could have selected these X1 instances of the first class, and then how many possible ways we could have selected these X2 instances for the second class, and so on and so on. For that, we need the multinomial coefficient, which can again be explicitly computed using factorials. We will use the multinomial distribution today, but we will only use this part, right? So if you haven't met multinomial coefficient or something, then it's fine. It's just there to take care of computing the like really number of ways how this outcome could appear. By the way, it's also possible to describe what the conjugate prior of the categorical distribution is. And well, it's surprise, surprise, a generalization of the beta distribution. And again, it's really just a product of X to some exponents, right? Because of this part. And there is some normalization constant again, which makes sure that this all sounds one. It's called the Dirichlet distribution. And again, these parameters alpha play the role of counts of the individual classes, and then the priors really correspond to some initial counts. So this was like a tour into the more probable distributions. And now let's get started with our main topic, and that's the naive Bayes classifier. So far, our classifiers were so-called discriminative. That means that we really try to predict the probability of the output class given the input features. However, we might instead use the Bayes theorem and rewrite the probability of the class X to the probability of the class itself times the probability of the data given the class and then divided by probability of the data. If we want to perform classification, and really just want to compute the argmax of that, then in the argmax, this denominator doesn't play any role because X is then fixed, right? So if we classify using such a classifier, what we are interested in is just this, the prior over the classes times the likelihood, like the probability of the data given the class. So instead of modeling the classes given the data, we model the data given the class. Problematic part is, of course, how we model the data with respect to the classes. Like the data can be pixels, there are various non-trivial, for example, in the NIST dataset. This what this means is like the probability of some like drawn image given that our class is, for example, 8. Right, so modeling this might be extremely difficult because X can be really highly dimensional. There can be a lot of dependence between the individual features. So modeling that is not straightforward. And for that, we will use the naive Bayes. So the naive Bayes classifier assumes or does a so-called naive Bayes assumption. And the assumption is that all the features of our data are independent given the class. It's really a technical assumption to allow us to say, okay, when we are interested in modeling the data, then we could write it like this. Like we could model the first feature, then the second feature depending also on the first feature, and then the third feature depending on the first and second, and so on. And that's fine. But this assumption that if we see CK, then X2 and X1 are independent, we can really get rid of them, all of these elements, and model this probability of the data by the product of the individual features given the class. And now the situation is substantially more optimistic because this is a distribution over just a single dimension, over just a single quantity. And this thing we can model much easier than an n-dimensional thing here. So in the naive Bayes, there are actually many ways how we can model the distributions of the individual features given the target classes. So we will discuss three, the most commonly used ones. The first is the Gaussian naive Bayes. In the Gaussian naive Bayes, we expect these distributions to be normal, right? So for a given class and a given feature, we model these features of the data with this class by a normal distribution with some mean and variance. So let's say that we have some training data and we want to do K-class classification, so we have got the targets. So the training of our algorithm is just estimation of all these distributions. So it's just the estimation of these means and variances for all the features and all the classes. And in order to estimate them, we will just use the maximum likelihood. So now let the feature D and the class K be fixed, right? So we will be estimating a single of these distributions. And so let's say that X1 to XNK are the training data, which corresponds to the class K. So we are only interested in the data of a single class right now, right? Because we want to model what the data looks like, for example, for number 3, or we want to see what the data looks like if you consider the documents which are about sport. right? So we only have this collection of data of this same class, and we have got nk of them. So we already actually know, now we want to go for the maximum likelihood, right? So we know how to do maximum likelihood estimation using n samples drawn from a Gaussian distribution, because we have computed it when we were showing that the mean square error is actually maximum likelihood of a normal distribution. So we arrived there that if we have some samples from a normal distribution, that the maximum likelihood estimation, so the mean and variance, should minimize the negative log likelihood. So this is negative log likelihood. This is like the constant term, like the initial part in the normal distribution. This is the exponent, like the x minus mu squared divided by 2 sigma squared. So this is the negative log likelihood of some number of observations under the Gaussian distribution. So in order to find out what the best possible values of the parameters are, well, we'll do the same thing which we have done always. So we will compute the derivative and set it to zero, right? So we will compute the derivative. So the derivative with respect to mean, well, the only interesting mean is here, right? So the derivative is x minus mu times, well, this minus goes from this minus, this 2 comes from this 2, right? And this should be equal to 0. So now we can easily rewrite this by the first, we can, for example, cancel this one. We can really multiply this by 2 times sigma squared, and it will go away. Then we can get rid of this 2. We can get rid of this minus. And then we can move this to the other side. So we would have nk times the mu dk. And out of that, we get that this mean should really be just the average of the data. So what I'm showing you is something what you probably know. Like, if you want to estimate the mean of a normal distribution, well, or even just any distribution, you just compute the average. That's what you have been doing probably for quite some time. But this is actually like proven correct, or this actually comes from really direct maximum likelihood estimation on the parameters. Now we can do the same thing for the variances. So we can again zero out the derivative with respect to the variance. And if we do it, then surprise, surprise, we will get the formula that we will estimate the variance really by computing the observed variance or population variance divided by 1 over nk. I guess for the people who have some experience, might be surprising, but this is really the result of maximum likelihood estimation, right? We never said that maximum likelihood estimation is unbiased, and this is really a biased output. And that's all, this is it, right? This is all there is to Gaussian naive Bayes. We really just, during training, compute these centers, means, and the variances, and that's it. One trick is that sometimes the variance might be too small, and that would create two sharp distributions, and that might be very impractical. So it's usually slightly improved or increased in scikit-learn. This default increase value is 10 to minus 9 times the largest variance of our features, and it's just for fun so that you know it. We can look at some visualization. So we have the data from the MIST dataset. So we always only consider the data of one class. So these are the means of the pixels for the class 0, right? So these are various features, various Ds for k being 0, and these are the means, right? So whenever you have a pixel and you have a zero in the input, then there is a reasonable chance that this pixel will be selected. We also estimate the standard deviations, actually, right? So you can see that the middle is there all the time, and then you can see that the outline and the inline are actually slightly more intense because the variations are larger there. Like the differences in the middle are not that large. So it might be funny that there are these weird holes, but when you think about it, it definitely makes sense. And here in the bottom, we actually overlay both of these together. So you can see that this kind of model actually has some idea of what the input data looks like, right? Because it kind of modeled what these fours actually look like when we classify something as four. So that was Gaussian main base. Now, there might be other features, not just normally distributed ones. So assume for the time being that the features are binary. So then this distribution is really just a distribution over binary features, and we might model it using a Bernoulli distribution. Right? So this is just the formula of that. Therefore, we can write that the probability of the class given data is, here we have the product of probability of the individual features given CK and then the prior. Now we can rewrite this into the log space by saying, okay, the logarithm of this. Now we only have proportional to. So there is some unknown multiplicative constant. So after logarithming, it will be some additive constant. So I'm just writing it here, and in the end, then we will see that it will not be important there. So the logarithm, the log likelihood of class K given X is the log likelihood of the prior. And then we have the logarithm of these. So it's sum of the logarithms. This one is just XD times the logarithm of this. And we can actually combine all the XDs together, right? So this thing, that's like minus XD times 1 minus PDK. And we can combine these XDs together, right? So we get like this part is here and this part is here. And then we have some remaining constant, which is this. When you look at it from the view of X, this is actually some constant value plus the input features times some weights. So in the end, this log likelihood looks just like a linear model, like some constant plus X times weights. And again, so I said that this constant doesn't really depend on the class. So for prediction, whenever we are going for argmax, we don't care about it, so we can ignore it. And so the prediction is actually the prediction using a linear model. So now you can see that this, in a sense, seems quite similar to what we did in some kind of multinomial logistic regression. But we are training the model very differently. To estimate the probabilities, we will again use the maximum likelihood estimation. So for that, we will take the likelihood, turn it into log likelihood, right? So we have the log likelihood. We will compute the derivative with respect to the probability and obtain the result. So I'm not going through the computation as straightforward as it was with the Gaussian naive base. But what is the outcome? It says that PDK should be the number of data of class K with feature D being 1 divided by the number of data of class K. And that's all hidden there. So What this PDK is the probability that class K will have the dth feature 1. So it is definitely a reasonable idea to estimate it by actually observing what number of documents had this feature non-zero. Right. However, there is a slight problem. And that slight problem is that we can overfit in a setting that if feature D is always set to 1, then this estimate will be 1. And we will completely rule out the possibility of a feature being 0 for the given class, right? If we really respect the data and we just see that, I don't know, all the numbers 3 had a pixel exactly here, then whenever we don't see a pixel there, we would say that the probability of this to be 0, probability of this to be 3 is 0, right? Because we never seen that. And that's bad, right? Being able to make one feature to say, okay, that this class is definitely not viable, that's a bad idea. So in order to deal with that, people have proposed something called additive or Laplace smoothing, where in the estimation of the probability, we just add plus some constant and plus do the same alphas here for some pseudo count alpha larger than 0. Now this might seem tacky, right? So we achieve the probability not being equal to 1. That's a good thing, but some bad thing also happens. Like, why does it work? Like, what is the interpretation? What's happening? But we can actually interpret this from the point of the Bayesian probability, right? If instead of using maximum likelihood estimation, we would use maximum a posteriori estimation and have some prior, right? Some prior estimate, for example, using the beta with some non-trivial observations, then we would get exactly this formula, right? So this smoothing is actually just is the result of considering a prior. We consider that there is some reasonable chance that both features 0 and 1 will be present in the digit 3. And this prior information then never gets completely deleted during the estimation, and then is actually present in the final estimate and allows us to consider even feature values which we never saw during training. So this is why we went through this beta and Dirichlet and Bayesian probability, so that you understand what these constants, how they can be interpreted. So the last variant of the naive Bayes, which we'll describe, is the multinomial naive Bayes. In the multinomial naive Bayes, we model this as a multinomial distribution. So it's really like a XD occurrences of feature D. Right, so it's like a... So similarly to the Bernoulli naive Bayes, we can rewrite the log likelihood, really like the logarithm of that, as the sum of xd times logarithm of the probability. So the log probability is again just a linear model. We again use the maximum likelihood estimation to come up with the values of the probabilities. I will just skip that. But in the end, what happens is that the final probability of feature D in class K, right? So this is like the probability that we will see some value of the feature D for class K. So we will sum all the feature values of this feature D for class K and divide it by all the feature values, right? So we have got the data, some of them have class K. We are now interested in the feature D. So what we do is we sum all of them right? And then we divide it by all of the features in this class. By the way, this should be J. Right, so this tells us how much this feature D appears in this document compared to the other features. Right, if you consider these to be verts in the, for example, TF-IDF, right, then this tells you what is the probability of some specific term D appearing in the document. Right, this sum here is the sum of all verts in all the documents, and this tells you like the sum of occurrences of a specific word D. So this is really just the probability of vert in the class K being D, in the case where we would use just counts to represent our documents, right? And again, to avoid these values to be zeros or ones, we add, again, the Laplace smoothing, but we can consider it a Dirichlet prior so that it has some interpretation. And in practice, what does it mean is that apart from the counts, from like the number of features appearing in the data, we add the some pseudo count, some pseudo observation, alpha, like 0.1 occurrence of a given word. Now, because here we have D different terms, and we have actually added alpha to all of them, right? And in the denominator, this alpha is multiplied by D because we are considering D classes. So we can look at the results of all the three kinds of naive Bayes. You can see that the results are not really that much different. In the Bernoulli, they seem to be the most intense. Well, that's because we are binarizing the inputs, like we need binary variables, so the digits are binary when we model them, right? So that's why they have the largest value. With the multinomial naive Bayes, the pixels actually competes with each other, right? We are considering the distribution of the pixels over whole image. Here we just consider each pixel independently, but here we really consider the distribution over everything. So that's why the probabilities are much lower, right? Because here we know that the sum over the whole image should go to one, while here we just consider each pixel independently. So the choice between these naive Bayes, it depends on the feature values. So if they are normal distributed, then Gaussian naive Bayes is the obvious choice. To use multinomial naive Bayes, the features should be multinomial. What does it mean is they are non-negative, they are some kind of counts, and they compete with each other, right? So if you are choosing, for example, a word for a document, right, then the individual words are competing, either it's word A or B, right? So the larger probability of a word is, the less probability of the other words probably are, right? And the higher values should be less likely. That's what the multinomial distribution is like, choosing one of k possibilities n times. The features can actually be revalued. Of course, in the original distribution, when we talk about counts of successes and failures, these can be only integral, but the distribution can be generalized to real value observation using the gamma function. So this is the, for example, the good choice for using the TF-IDF as feature representations, right? Then they are also competing with each other, and the larger means more influence, so that's a good fit. And in a base, the features must be binary, which is a disadvantage. No TF-IDFs for Bernoulli distributed and a base. However, the importance different. The important difference is that, contrary to multinomial naive Bayes, also the absence of features is being modeled. Right. So we have a probability of a term being there, but also the probability of a term not being there. So if we classify text whether it's like positive and negative, then the multinomial Navy base can just have the positive words, and they are stronger the more frequent they appear. But in Bernoulli Navy base, we can also consider like negative words, we can consider a positive word not being present. So if nice is not being there, good, fine is not being there, then this will probably penalize the input. So the absence of terms can be modeled. So that's why it still makes sense to consider it. So I'm sorry, I still have a few more slides here. It will be fast. So I'm sorry I'm taking more time. So of course, feel free to leave if you need to go. And I'm sorry I spent I was fast enough at the beginning. Feel free to watch the recording if you need to leave, and I should be done in something like 4 minutes. And so the last topic which I want to discuss, now that we have everything in our heads, is the distinction between generative and discriminative models. So until now, all our models have been discriminative. And by that I mean that it modeled the conditional distribution of the targets given the data. The generative models, on the other hand, they estimate the joint distribution. So they estimate also the distribution of the data, usually by modeling the distribution of the targets, classes, and then the data. So, and then they transform this quantity into the conditional probability only during prediction. So visually, we can consider it like this. In the discriminative modeling, we really try to estimate the decision boundary itself, nothing more. We find the decision boundary, and then it means we can classify the inputs depending on which side of these boundaries they are. In the generative models, and name base is generative model, we estimate the density of the data, right? So we really say, okay, for this red class, this data, they appear here. For the blue class, the data, they appear here, right? And then if you want to decide whether a point is blue or red, we just measure the probability of the point being generated by the red cloud or by the blue cloud, and whoever is the has the larger likelihood, and whoever has the larger prior wins. So empirically, the discriminative models perform better in classification tasks, because finding out the decision boundary might be much easier than finding the densities of the data. On the other hand, the generative models can actually, they have something as well. They have the probability of the data. So what they can do is they can recognize anomalies, outliers, or out of distribution data, whatever you call it, like the data, which has extremely low probability. Like in the discriminative model, data like this is just being classified as blue. Like here, data like this can give you warning. Like this doesn't seem like any of the data which we have seen during training. Now the term generative comes from at least a theoretical possibility of generating actually the data, right? We have seen in the NIST that we probably should be able to generate the digits right now, right? Because the model actually has an idea of what the input data looks like. So just being a generative model doesn't mean that we can efficiently produce the samples. However, in recent years, this generative modeling combined with deep neural networks allowed people to create models which can actually generate samples. And these are actually images produced by some neural networks in this generative sense. So it was trained by really training a model PX and then sampling from it. And these are all automatically generated. So, and I will be just, okay, the last thing is when you consider the logistic regression and naive base, then they are the so-called generative discriminative pair, because both of these models, they perform a prediction by computing the log likelihood as a linear model. They just differ in a way how they do it. Logistic regression uses some kind of an SGD or something, while the naive Bayes relay models the data, and using these estimates, it creates the linear model. Now, quite some information are known about the logistic regression and naive Bayes. And what's known is that if the assumed model is correct, especially in the naive Bayes, then asymptotically, both of these converge to the same performance. However, if the model is not correct, then the logistic regression can be just better or equal. So the discriminative models are as good as generative or maybe even better at classification. So that seems okay. Let's go for discriminative models. However, there is a trade-off, and the trade-off is that in logistic regression, it might take some time to reach reasonable error. So generally, if a model has d features, we will need roughly d training examples to reach the reasonable performance. However, for naive Bayes, only a logarithmic number of examples is enough. So the generative models, they have worse asymptotic performance usually, but they can be trained using much less training data. So if you have a data set which has little training data, then using a generative model might be better for you, because even if you are not in a limit case, an asymptotic case, your performance would not be that good as a discriminative model, but you can reach it given that you have really like a small number of training data. And the last slide is just the effect of that, showing various data sets and whether logistic regression, the meshed line, or the naive Bayes is actually better during training of very small number of training data. Okay, thank you very much for your attention. If you have any question, then feel free to ask. I will stop the recording and be here. So don't hesitate to. Thank you very much for your attention. Enjoy the finish up work on our competition assignment. And I'm looking forward to meeting you tomorrow on the practicals. Thanks. See you.